Welcome once again to Core Ideas, a paleolimnology podcast where we delve into all things lake sediments. As usual, we are your hosts for the show, myself, Adam Jaziorski.
And myself, Josh Theenpot. Thanks for coming back again, joining us on the first episode of our, are they seasons? Do you call them seasons when there are six of them that you released in like a month and a half?
In my mind, I'm just thinking of them as more as arcs rather arcs. Than
I like arc better. I really do just, like arc better.
Of just like a general thread. And so whereas we've spent the last several episodes focused on fundamentals of paleolimnology to develop a vocabulary that we can refer back to going forward, here it's some lighter fare. We're going into the weeds a little bit. I have a couple of topics that are of more general interest in terms of paleo. Today we're going to be talking about the joy of field work.
Then we're going to talk a little bit about computing and paleo, and not how we use computing. We're certainly not going to get into the method part, but more the history and how it's linked to paleo and how things have kind of co-developed. We have our first interview, I believe, scheduled.
The person, is it official?
I think it's official.
Have we asked?
Yeah, we can speak. Yeah, I asked. Yeah. Professor Jenny Carosi, who also lives in the same house as me, so that helps, given the current situation, will be joining us for an episode this season. What else have we talked about? Grad studies and a little bit on that. I haven't really fleshed that one out.
But, you know, you want to be a grad student. What does that mean? Especially from the perspective of paleolimnology, like what does it mean to do a master's versus a PhD? Basically questions that I, you know, went into completely ignorant of the answer and just figured out as I went along and passing, as I'm an old man now, pass on some words of wisdom to the nobody that's listening.
Yeah, exactly. And a couple other topics as well that we'll add into this this delving into the weeds, which I really like as a title. But today we're going to talk about fieldwork and the joys of fieldwork with some big air quotes about joy.
The highest of highs and the lowest of lows.
Yeah, for sure. And I do want to preface this by saying that, you know, we're pretty lucky, both of us, and we'll tell some funny stories, hopefully, while we think they're funny. And maybe have a few tips, hopefully, that are useful if you've never been in the field, and you may not be going this year, but you're going to be out there soon. But I personally have never had any really bad field experiences, nothing where anyone was injured badly or heaven forbid killed. But those things do happen, and happily not that often in paleolimnology, obviously, but in field work in general. So just to preface that, to say that this is all meant to be fun, but nothing in the history is really, really dark in our personal experiences, and that's not the case for everyone. So let's get that out there.
Okay. And so I thought we'd begin just by, like we talked about, retrieving sediment cores, but we can kick it off with a little bit more just talking about in more general terms about fieldwork and paleolimnology and what that entails. Because in order to have some sediment to work on in the sediment, you have to go out and collect it. But really, paleolimnology is largely a laboratory and microscope-focused discipline. So compare it to some other fields where you could be out for months at a time collecting your data. Really, paleo field season is relatively short, in the order of like days to weeks. Like, what's the longest you've ever been out continuously for any particular
field away from season? Home? A month.
Yeah, so
4 weeks. But that was a fair bit of driving to get there, and the pace was not, you know, there was a lot of time built into that to accommodate things going a little bit off kilter. And that was a really long trip. On average, I would say 2 weeks is, you know, to 18 days is the longest I'm away. That would be the median for sure, is 2 weeks.
Yeah. And it all depends on where you're going, because travel time is a huge aspect of it all.
Oh, yeah, for sure. In that 2 weeks, I would say that, you know, 4 or 5 of those days are related to travel and getting prepped when you get there, for sure.
And, you know, just for general perspective, like really for a master's student or a master's project, you can collect, depending on how close they are together, you know, especially in a single lake kind of study, you can collect all the cores you need in one day once you're there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And no question. Even if you're collecting not just sediments, you're collecting water, you might be doing some net toes or plankton toes or whatever other samples, it'd be very straightforward in a week to collect all of the samples you're going to use and maybe some ancillary projects on top of that too.
But a lot of the work from a paleo sense really comes down to the logistics planning and making sure your equipment works and dealing with equipment failures in the field preparing in terms of, getting to know your field team, getting to know your equipment. It's a good idea if you're, depending on whether you're collecting from a boat or a canoe or a Zodiac, to actually have used it beforehand before you were at your mission critical moment.
Make sure you have everything to blow up the boat. You have the at least one pump if you're going to be using an inflatable boat, because it's amazing how much harder it is to patch a rubber or PVC boat when you're not in the lab.
Absolutely. And one thing that I've kind of taken away from coring a little bit is on some field teams, you want to have an idea beforehand of who's going. And as sad as it is, kind of say some element of muscles and or height are kind of a key requirement on the team in terms of, you know, there's going to be some pulling of cores. If you're going by canoe, you need to have at least two people on the team that are tall enough to be able to lift it on top of your truck. Keeping in mind that you may be renting a rental truck much taller than the car that you're used to driving or have done your test day on. So there are some physical aspects of it, but really in the grand scheme of things, it's not that tough as long as you have your very base level stuff covered.
Yeah. And I think that's a good point about what it is you're using as your platform for your sediment collection is really important for some of those logistics. If you're working from a inflatable, like a Zodiac, which is a brand, but you know what I mean, an inflatable boat, those things may not be as important because you're going to take it down. You know, you're going to inflate it at the site probably. They're a lot less tippy, so you can have two people kind of working together to take the core. It's easy for two people to be leaning over the edge of one of those even small Zodiacs. In a canoe, that's not going to be the case. It's going to be more or less up to one person to do a lot of it themselves while the other person is keeping the boat stable.
Yeah, it's basically so, the counterweight.
Yeah, exactly. So knowing how you're going to take your cores is a part of planning in that sphere to decide who would make a good team for that, or how you'll work together, whatever the team composition is, how you'll delve up or distribute out the different jobs. So we've talked about canoes. We talked about inflatable boats. The other option that isn't probably as common, but for any case where you're going to get onto a bigger lake, you may be working from a larger boat, which seems great. It's great to have a fishing boat or a pontoon boat or something with a motor on it, because one, you don't have to paddle the darn thing. But two, you get a lot of space in the boat. But sometimes that can be a little more challenging than it would seem at the face of it. The freeboard, so that's the height from the water to the top of the edge of the boat, can get much larger as you get to a larger vessel. And because of that, it can become more challenging to be able to reach in, especially if you're using a gravity core, obviously, to plug that core if you are, instead of being only a few inches above the waterline, going to be more like a foot or a foot and a half above the waterline or more.
I'm not going to name any names, but I can think of a classic photo of a certain graduate student being held by her ankles by two field team members to cap the core that was being pulled.
Oh, I've been like someone like stand on my feet. I am not positive I'm not going to go in here if I have to get a little bit closer from like a pontoon boat, which are generally quite high off the water. So that's those are great. You can get cover a lot more lake a lot faster, but there are challenges associated with every type of coring platform, whatever that might be. And knowing sort of the logistical constraints is really critical to having a good experience when you're out there and collecting good samples.
And I know for a fact that you've done the gamut in terms of coring from a canoe versus an inflatable boat. I don't even know what the word would be for like a regular boat, like a where freeboard is concerned, helicopter, float plane. What is your preferred coring platform? Do you have a favorite? The ice.
Off the ice.
That's kind of funny. That's one that was massively missing from my list because it's something I've never done.
Yeah. Ice for sure. As long as it's a nice day. If I had to pick a platform, it would be an inflatable Zodiac style boat, I think. To me, it gives all of the kind of, you know, it's not perfect, but it does fit into all the things that are useful well. It's low to the water. They're stable, so you can like stand and hammer a corer in it. You can mount a small motor to it, or we use an electric trolling motor that has a car battery, which doesn't give you a lot of power, but it's better than paddling for when we use them around here. You can, you know, they're not crazy heavy. They blow up pretty fast. So to me, that's the perfect option. Unless you have to carry that thing through the woods because it weighs about 85 pounds and then it becomes a little more cumbersome.
Yeah, this is where I'm rolling my eyes because I've got some experience with the Zodiac, or I don't know if it's officially a Zodiac, I guess it's a brand name, but a Zodiac style boat. And then I go on a very small lake but the second you bring a motor into the equation, and usually if the whole point is you're dealing with the Zodiac, you know, and a pickup, it's because you can deflate it, which means you're also transporting a motor. And then you have to deal with packing that motor and then potentially it's spending a lot of time on its side and dealing with flooding. And
yeah,
have you ever
portaged
a motor?
No, I haven't. And the reason we use them is because we're usually transporting by helicopter to the site. And that means rolling it up and deflating it, rolling it up and putting it in the back of the helicopter is the only way. There's no way to get a canoe out there. You can sling out a big boat, but it's, you know, that's going to take double the helicopter time. So that's the only real option we have in a lot of the situations up north. So that's why, but I think it's a good platform. And locally we use them too. There are times when I've thought, you know, this would be faster with a canoe. You could drag this thing over bad terrain a lot easier, but it's still a really nice platform. Even though most of the time we don't use gas motors. In fact, the lab, we don't have any gas motors for the Zodiac. It's actually made by Mercury Inflatables. It's not a Zodiac.
Okay. No, I agree purely from the perspective of like the actual collecting the cores. Yes, the inflatable boat is the best because you can definitely have two people working together. You're very low to the water. You have room inside it to like move stuff around that you don't have in a canoe.
Usually something to tie your cores to in some sort of bucket. So there's lots of logistical things that are just, you know, a little bit easier when you got a little more space.
But on a more holistic level, I am very much on team canoe. Again, I don't have the northern or much northern experience. I guess all my northern stuff has been from the floats of a plane. So I wasn't dealing with any boats on that particular expedition. But a canoe, just it's light and slinging on top of the truck, less stuff to break. But the downside,
you can drag them over anything. Like you never worry about putting a hole in a decent canoe. No, I really enjoyed kind of using it in the situations that I have used it in. I think it was the right choice for most of those experiences. You don't want to portage an 85-pound boat all that often. It gets really boring. This is a good kind of discussion and something to think about because there is a best, it's not perfect, but there's a best option for almost every situation you're going to find yourself in.
All right. And then, so outside of logistics and equipment and deciding what you're going to do in terms of collecting your field core, I think one of the, at least for me, didn't really realize it until I was a little ways into the game, is how challenging field work can be in terms of personalities at times. Because if you're out on the road for 3 weeks away from your family with someone that you've just met, potentially, you know, in the run-up to the field season, it really can be a litmus test on whether or not you like field work and not everybody does. Some people, it's just ordeal that must be endured in order to do the rest of your project. And other people live for it, and it is the highlight of the whole paleo
experience. Yeah, for sure.
Experience.
It's the whole reason, not the whole reason, but it's the selling point for them being there.
And I think it's interesting that it really becomes a litmus test, because I've definitely been out there with people that were gung-ho, thinking it was the reason that they were there, and then kind of soured on it and said, let's just get this done.
Yeah.
I want to go home.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And that can change over the time you're out doing a field season. A longer field season becomes more mentally taxing as you get into it. The first couple of days may be great fun, but after, you know, you're having to do laundry at some laundromat you found, driving past, and haven't washed your hair properly in a little while, and just
sitting, this is a problem you have?
Not currently, no. At one point it might have been, not anymore. Sad face. But eating the same food, like how many Clif Bars can you eat over the course of 2 or 3 weeks? It's a lot, and you'll never want another one again at that point, or Nature Valley bars or whatever they are.
Well, that's kind of a key thing, is like the ability to deal with monotony of food is part of it. Like that's one of the make or breaks. If you were quite happy having peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for lunch every day for 3 weeks, then you're well on your way to dealing well with a field environment. Because
I just do that all year just so I'm always ready to be in the field.
Because you may have, or at least in my experience, I'm lazy. But you may have thoughts of having a very varied lunch and being more adventurous in terms of what your grocery run is going to be like at the beginning. But if you're doing really long days, like lots of drive and lots of time out in the sun, you know, it's like, let's just slap something together as quick as it degenerates into that very, very quickly.
Especially for lunches, because you're packing them before you go and you're thinking about, you're not thinking about food. You're thinking about work. You're thinking about making sure that you didn't forget the electrical tape today, like you did the day before, and the Vaseline and all those different, bits. And wait, we were drying the bungs where? We have to make sure we got 8 of them. Mm-hmm.
It's only 7.
Yeah, exactly. Where's the 8th one? Jesus, the squirrel took it. And, the last thing you think of is, oh, crap, I didn't pack a lunch. I'm just going to take a couple Clif Bars. So two things out of that is that pack more food than you're going to expect, you're going to need, because the day could end up longer than you expect. It may not go as well. And then don't make it elaborate, because you're not going to appreciate the culinary, Epicurean experience when you're out there, because you're going to be stuffing that sandwich in probably while you're driving to the next site or labeling some bags or whatever it is. Just get some hearty food and lots of it for field days. You can have a really nice kind of, this is my opinion anyway, and Adam's too, I know. You can have a really nice lunch on your off day, on your day when you're sectioning, if you're doing them on alternate days or when you're, in transit, not when you're in the field. That's why peanut butter and jam is the absolute perfect.
And I know I've pushed that quite hard. And so, yes, we're just going to say right out now, if you have peanut allergies, you're going to have a serious disadvantage in field environments, because all of a sudden your lunches became a lot more complicated.
You may actually be not on my list of people I would want to take. But this is, this is more of a personal thing about me in general. Is that
just general bigotry, really?
Well, against peanut, yes, yeah. I don't want to be that way. I did say before he was born that if our son had been born with or had developed a peanut allergy, I might not have taken to him as well, because peanut butter is a very important part of my life. No, there are lots of alternatives. But the thing, this is a little funny aside, is that the quote of Adam's that I use to other people, I say to other people more than any other by probably 100 times, is that peanut butter and jam sandwiches are the perfect field food. And that's because you can sit on them, you can get them wet, you can leave them in the bottom of your bag all day, and they taste exactly the same as they did when you put them in there.
And you can shake things up by changing the jam week to week.
You're sick in the head if you think. Strawberry. Yeah. And if we're adding these little tidbits of wisdom, I always make my sandwiches on bagels as opposed to on bread because they don't deform as much. So if you put, I would usually pack for myself like three sandwiches as a normal kind of full day out. If you make three bread sandwiches, you end up with one 6-piece of bread sandwich at the end of it because it's in the bottom of my bag with my, my camera and all that stuff. At least bagels hold some structural integrity during that process. And you might actually be able to eat them individually.
And I had not planned on spending as much time devoted to peanut butter sandwiches as we have spent. I'm not looking at the clock right now. But and it's supposed totally to be lost on you because you don't eat meat. But on the last Feeling season I went on, I had a bit of a revelation for the shakeup. Is the little individual serving cans of tuna that come in a variety of
like lemon sriracha pepper
type stuff, yep. Lemon pepper, all that, and just flatbread wraps. And you don't have to do anything. You can just throw the two packs in the bag and do it on the fly when you're hungry. And I've a solid 15 plus years into my field career, I guess you're going to say it. It was just like my eyes had been open for the first time. It's like, this is a whole aspect of like the grocery store I just walk by and not paying any attention to until now.
The very first field season we took to Nova Scotia, Brian Ginn had us buy what I thought was an obscene number of those little cans of tuna, and they came with crackers in the actual package. So it was like the kids have the cheese that they spread onto the crackers. It was the same thing except for adults, I guess, and tuna. And I ate so many of them that I probably never have. Well, I don't eat meat now, but never have one again. All lemon pepper. I think it was all they had at the Loblaws in Kingston. Just nothing but lemon pepper.
Oh, that might have been your problem.
I think it definitely was.
I still have them today, like just on a whim for a lunch.
Nothing wrong with that.
Change my life.
Food is critical.
And then what else were we going to say? Oh, in terms of field work and general working with the team, roles on the team and personalities, one thing that many people find shocking is how quickly you can burn through 4 life stories in the opening 18-hour drive to get to, the first place you're going to sample on your 3-week field season.
Yep, for sure. This is, if you may have gotten the hint there in Adam's voice, is that this is a personal story of the two of us and two others as we drove from Kingston to Halifax, or just outside of Halifax in Nova Scotia. Which is a 2-day drive. Well, it's not a 2-day drive, but you can do it in 2 days is the best way. And once you get there, now you've just started the trip. Now you have, what was it, 3 weeks in the in the back country? Well, a week in the back country of a national park and then a few other kind of trips around there. And my God, you think, even if you've lived such an exciting life as Adam had at that time anyway, you can go through all those stories real quick. And I've lived a boring existence, so I had nothing to say.
And so these kind of field excursions are, where real friendships can be made. Like it's like you and me. It's like that trip. Like we knew each other beforehand, but I think that we were friends after that. After that huge amount of time in close proximity and hanging out, and it's like, I've shared a lab bench we never shared an office for this guy for a while.
People used to get us confused. You remember some of the like senior, when I first started as an undergrad and Adam was just starting his PhD, some of the senior people thought we were the same person. Like I got called Adam a lot.
I never understood that.
I don't either,
That was the way you introduced yourself to me. It's like, you must be Adam. My name is Josh and BFC is looking for you.
That's right. Exactly.
He thinks I'm you.
Yeah. And that was, you go about your daily activities and I was still taking other courses. So there wasn't as much direct connection. And then it was only a couple of years later that we went on this trip. And after that, completely different. Yeah. No, you can definitely make some pretty strong bonds when you spend that much time with one another out in the field.
Yeah, and you can go through, within our network of paleo people, you know, you can point the finger at a lot of good friends when you go, oh, you know, you trace it back and say, ah, no, that it traces back to grad school and
yeah, for sure,
most likely in extended field work. A lot of friendships are forged in the fires of field work, dealing with problems of on the fly.
So, yeah, kind of shared slight misery, bad weather. You know, those are the kind of thing. The great days, you know, really nice days out are always great when you're there. But you tell stories about the bad days, not really bad, but you know,
difficult days, I guess, rather than bad days. You had
the difficult days. Yeah, that's the best way to put it.
When you get thrown curveballs, when everything is going fine, you're making good time, and then you are totally bewildered by your map, and you're not very far off the beaten path. And, you know, you're somewhere in Muskoka, per se, and you're like, we are there. There is no lake. What went wrong?
Yep.
Are we dumb? It's like, no, I know how to read this map. We are right there. There is no body of water here. What is going on? I guess this lends into, we can go a little bit down like the mishap line. Speaking of lines, do you have anything you'd like to say about lines in general?
Oh, that was a great pitch. As we were setting this up, the last segment was reserved for rants, funny stories, and that kind of thing. And we've got a little bit of time on this. And one I would like to make as more of a PSA, but
climb
also
on that soapbox.
A Josh rant.
Tell us how you really feel.
I'm up on top of it already. This is one that I live on, is that it would, I think, be very valuable for those who have never been in the field before. And then people who have been in the field many, many times to learn to tie one or two basic knots so that you do not lose equipment that is very valuable and may not be easily replaced if you're in for, say, the Outer Mackenzie Delta and you need to keep the boat from drifting along the lake and you have left the anchor in the bottom of a lake because the knot was not tied correctly, or you didn't tie it to the boat after someone, Josh, tied the knot correctly to the actual anchor and you didn't tie it to the boat correctly. So learn to tie a couple of knots. I would recommend knowing how to tie a bowline or a bowline. And also perhaps a knot you can look up called a highwayman's hitch, which is a great way to tie the line to the boat without having to actually tie a proper knot that's going to be difficult to undo. The axiom about if you don't know how to tie knots, tie lots, was said by people who don't know how to tie
knots. Just for counterpoint, I am one of those people, and I tie knots and lots of knots. Because I know how to tie bowline deep down in my brain, but I go into the field so rarely. Yep. I'm a consummate city boy. And, it's just, I get out there, and it's like, there's a rabbit go around the tree.
Doesn't have to be a bowline.
He goes around the tree. He's out. Does he start in the hole? He goes out of the hole, around the tree, back into the hole. Is that right?
I don't know. I can do it with my eyes closed. I don't actually know. And I have a hard time teaching people because it's so ingrained. Doesn't have to be a bowline. Learn how to tie a double figure eight knot. Go to a climbing gym. That's how I first learned how to tie knots. We had a climbing gym in our high school, and that's a knot that you would put on your harness to keep you from falling. And the teacher never came and checked. So whatever. So here you go, kids. Enjoy. I forgot where I was going with that little aside.
Nice.
But yeah, learn how to tie a couple of knots. It has some value.
Yeah. Because it's not just for anchors. I mentioned canoes a lot. You'll want to be able to ensure that the canoe is actually affixed to the roof of your vehicle in some way, shape, or form.
Yep, sure. All of them can be done with a bowline. That's not to say it's the perfect knot for every situation. An anchor bend might be better to attach an anchor, and if you know how to do that, power to you. But the bowline will get you through all sorts of great situations. And I thank Brian Ginn again for making us sit and learn how to tie them before we went in the field the first time. As we were labeling some bags, he just had to sit with a piece of rope and just tie knots.
He had a nautical background, doesn't he?
He was in the in the Navy, yeah, for sure. Not old enough, if you're listening, Brian, not old enough to be in the Navy where they needed to tie lots of ropes, but like the sailing Navy, but yeah, for sure.
So yes, so I don't really have any rants.
Phew, oh, I'm so glad I got that off my chest on record, because I've been telling this to people for a long time, and it's nice to have that out there so I can just direct them to episode 7 of the podcast.
And then I don't have any equivalent rants really. Most of my, not even rants, but just like, type moments stem really from, paddling. And so in the same vein as wanting to have some idea of how to tie knots before you go anywhere, if you're going to be using a canoe, it's probably worth having a little bit of familiarity with the canoe before you get in and it's loaded with your gear. And and just 'cause things can go sideways pretty quickly.
Literally.
And like my one real field mishap that I've been party to was everything was going swimmingly. We were paddling on the same Nova Scotia field season that Josh already alluded to, along the apparently ironically named Still Brook. It is a lie. And we were going to a dock on Still Brook.
Yeah.
And
exactly, like a built
as structure. Part of a portage route. And just as, and there was a tightening of the stream, river. Well, I guess it wasn't really a river. But there was
creek.
And the brook. And, you know, there was some rapids a little ways off. And just we weren't paying super attention because we're just going to a dock. And as many other people in this park had done a thousand times before, but the water levels were, I guess, much higher than they were normally. And basically, as we were reaching for the dock, the current snagged us and sucked us into the rapids. And within 5-10 seconds, we'd been tipped out. All our gear had been tipped out. The canoe was sideways against some rocks. And I was...
Luckily, someone had tied all the gear to the boat with some really good knots. So
I think there's also been some messy knots as well. And that held. And basically, I was standing in the rapids, stopping the canoe from being sucked down further, screaming to Josh.
To the next lake and sent out into the next lake.
To Josh to throw me a line. And, you know, it goes from 0 to 11 very, very quickly.
Yeah, and that was one of those situations that had a happy ending in the end. I think actually, if I'm not mistaken, something, an oar maybe, or a paddle did end up downstream because it floated past and was in the next lake that we were going to. We definitely had to go and pick something up in the next lake, whether it was a life jacket. No, it wouldn't have been a life jacket. Anyway, something had floated.
Well, we lost away. Like a whole bunch of stuff went out of the canoe, and I was basically had a line around me. And I was reaching into the rapids, picking up like the core and stuff.
Yeah, it was a bit of a river rescue situation. Yeah.
But I don't think we actually lost anything.
No, I think we got everything. And I mean, you could stand in the water, so it wasn't
deep rapids. They weren't very fast rapids, but they were, you know, not rapids.
There were things breaking for sure. Yeah, exactly. And it just is one of those things that you don't expect little things like that to happen. And it was getting late in the day. We'd already done a bunch of work. We were trying to make it to a ranger cabin. Oh, the ranger cabin. That's right. We were staying in the national park there.
It would have sucked if we were camping that night.
For sure. And
this is where I learned firsthand exactly how much water a sleeping bag can hold. And it is tons.
Yeah, no doubt. And we were pretty smart about the things, not knowing that was going to happen yet. We had two people in each boat. We had two people in each boat. And we had a set of spare things. And there's some pretty funny pictures of Adam dressed in all my extra, like, warm weather gear because all his stuff was soaked while we rang out his sleeping bag. So we had spares of most things. We had tents in case we hadn't found the cabin. But
yeah. And really I'm a bit larger than Josh. It's not a flattering photo.
And it did, but it did make you remember that, you know, don't expect everything to go exactly as planned, because if you do that, you're not going to be prepared for those weird little things that just happened on the field.
And that was on day one. That was on day one. We'd not done anything.
Nope. Yeah.
We were planning to arrive in the park. First lake the next day.
Yeah. The idea is that that could have been really, really bad in terms of like losing a corer. What would we have done? We were on a 5-day portaging route that we weren't going back to the car for. You know, things happen.
Yeah.
But it does make a funny story now.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Especially the still brook aspect. That still kind of makes me
the irony of the name is just spectacular.
You know. And then what else? What else do we want to talk about? You've got a little bit here about the importance of sunscreen.
Oh yeah, this is one that, unlike where I know how to tie a lot of different knots, I always forget to put my sunscreen on. And the worst, and not on nice days, like beautiful days when it's sunny and you expect to, you know, be out on a nice day, are not the days I forget. The days I forget are in the middle of the winter, and you don't realize how much sun reflects off of the ice of a lake up under your hat or under your sunglasses. And the worst sunburn I've ever had in my life. Jesse Vermeer and I were out on a lake in Fort McPherson, so about an hour and a half helicopter flight from Inuvik. And it was a beautiful day. And my God, though, was I roasted after that. I was absolutely like in a peeling sunburn coming back into Toronto in whatever, April. People looking at me like, where have you? Oh, look at this guy who's been down south. Like, nope, was up in the middle of the Mackenzie Delta. Thanks, though. So, yeah, wear your sunscreen every day.
Yeah, so that's it. Basically, I'm on team sunscreen as well, but for slightly different reasons, because I don't have as much anywhere near the northern experience you do, and I've largely gone by the philosophy of, if I can't wear shorts, I'm not really interested.
That's a pretty good deal, yeah. I don't remember the last time I wore shorts in the field, frankly. If it's not cold, the bugs are out, so not going to be good.
Yeah, no. So, well, if you're doing all your coring from canoe, basically swimming trunks are the field gear of the day. Perfect. So you can just be absolutely soaked with all the stuff that you're pulling in and have a dip afterwards.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and then... then what else would we have in terms of pearls of wisdom in our expeditions? I think one, from a southern, I guess, relatively speaking, southern Ontario point is I was shocked at how difficult finding lakes can be in, or not finding lakes, but finding access to lakes can be in like the Muskoka region, because for some reason, on smaller lakes, the public launches are usually very well hidden.
Yeah, for sure. And I found that's the case in Nova Scotia as well.
Yeah.
The times I've been there.
It's like...
And I bet you this would be more broadly applicable than you'd think. I bet you that's probably fairly common all over more southern locations into the States and other locations as well.
Yeah, like... where the signs have been moved to protect someone's little slice of heaven. And it's usually a very poorly maintained access. It's just basically a little like dirt track.
Gravel bar, yeah.
And so it's not very visible. But the kind of thing that you'll drive back and forth past like 10 times, not realizing that is the boat access because there is no signs. And that can be infuriating.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Because you know it's there.
Yeah.
We did that just this year. We were out, just went for a day trip in order to try and get some sediment for a master's student, and knew there was a boat launch. People go and sample the lake all the time. But if you don't know where it is, my God.
Yeah.
Nope. No idea.
Yeah.
But in a lot of those situations, like in that situation, some really nice people let us access the lake through their property, and that can be the case. You can find some really good people.
I can't, yeah.
Who can make up for those kind of access issues. But in other cases, you may not have as much luck with the local
community. Batting average on door knocking sucks. Like maybe I'm just, you know, an unsavory looking individual or something. But
maybe, yeah.
I'm, you know, definitely you want the nicest looking person of your field team to be the one doing the door knocking.
I've actually not had that bad luck with it. I really hate doing it for whatever reason. I can't remember more than one or two examples of being told no, that you weren't, they weren't going to be accommodating in that situation. So I've had, I think, pretty good luck with that. It's not the looks, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, no, I guess maybe I've just done a fair bit more. I've definitely ran into some.
Maybe where you go.
Yeah, real.
Most of my, like, I think in a lot of places down east, you're probably going to get a little more uptake than you might get in kind of Ontario cottage country.
Yeah, like some real negative ones and a vibe of no, and if you come back knocking again, I'll shoot you kind of vibe. It's like, has happened more than once, and it's like, but you just gotta figure it out, and then you find out where that tiny little hidden launch is, and it's like, I didn't need to use your fancy dock anyway. That's
right. Make sure you drop a waypoint on your GPS for that location.
Think that's, I don't really have any more to add, but just in terms of like field work, yeah, it's like high highs, low lows. You know, it's very rare that you come back empty handed. Those are, you know, usually you don't always come back with everything you wanted, but, you come back with something and, you know, your projects develop from there in many ways.
Yeah, for sure. Bad weather might be I've been on one trip that I think we came back with not what we went looking for. We had to find completely different things, but that was weather related. And of all the times I've been up north, you figure it out, you get it done. And you may have to do a little bit of adapting, but that works out in the end and everyone's happy with what the solution is in the end. And you'd come back with some stories after that too.
And I would 100% encourage, you know, people that, you know, are thinking about doing something that involves some field work, you know, don't dodge it. It can, you know, I guess mentioned earlier, the consummate city slicker, you know, the vast majority of my time in the quote unquote bush has been field work related. I'm not an avid camper or anything like that. And a lot of good times have been had.
Yeah, for sure. I would qualify myself in, maybe not as much now that I'm a little more tied down, but was the person who would always go in the field. I was always ready to join any field team. And it probably cost me a little bit of time during my grad studies by helping other people do a lot of their field work, but I regret none of those experiences.
No, I think in those, you know, a couple of weeks or even a semester, I think the payoff, because I guess this is one thing that we totally glossed over, but field work can be cool, but field work where you are the assistant and bear no responsibility whatsoever for the, you know, whether or not you, like if hypothetically speaking, you came back empty handed, it doesn't really affect you because you were just there as an extra set of hands. Those are by far the best field trips.
Oh yeah, for sure. Now field work's really stressful because there's logistical constraints on top of it.
Yeah. But when you're along for the ride to help, and so I'd say, you know, any recommendation I would give to a grad student where, you know, there's chances to tag along because someone needs help. You know, all the stuff we mentioned beforehand, developing friendships, going somewhere new, doing something different, that's cool. But but on top of that, when the stress is actually quite low, that's when you really enjoy it.
And you get your skill set up and you become that person who, you know, when someone's looking for somebody who's done that kind of coring or that technique, you're that person. And
it's not a bad person to be.
It adds up to other field experiences and you get to see new places and meet a different core of people that are out there. And yeah, there's not, if you can, and not everyone can, it's a great opportunity. And I think the last thing I would say is that we only talked about a few little things. This is probably the first of a semi-recurring series on the quote-unquote joys of fieldwork. We'll dig up some more stories that come to mind, and a few other rants or little tidbits of take-home knowledge. So we'll probably do another one of these in the future. But for now, I think that probably covers this one.
And I think, you know, if you think about anything you'd like to add or have us to talk about in the future, drop us a line. You can do it via Twitter. Our Twitter handle is
At Core Ideas Paleo, P-A-L-E-O.
And the email address for longer form responses. There's nothing currently in the mailbag, but I keep on checking, is coreideaspodcast@gmail.com. And all of our show notes are posted at coreideas.ajeziorski.ca. So Ajeziorski is A-J-E-Z-I-O-R-S-K-I. And we have the notes of everything we've talked about of all the episodes so far. And that's where you get the full, I guess, season arc of fundamentals. And now we're moving on into some lighter fare about things that we find interesting in paleo.
Exactly. Other topics that we're interested in talking about. And if you have any suggestions to add to a future arc, let us know and we'll definitely put an episode together on that.
Yeah. And so thanks for listening. And we'll be back again next week to go into the weeds again on something a little bit different, talking about computing in paleo. But thanks for listening and see you soon.
Yep. Take care.